But before I introduce Luna, just wanted to give a preview of the events that are still going to be upcoming this term. So today is going to be the first of the LSE Inequality Seminar Series. The second event will be on the 16th of October, featuring Neil Lee from the Department of Geography and Environment, who's going to be scrutinizing the social policy concept of inclusive growth. On the 13th of October, we'll have Zamila Bungawala, who's going to be a GRF fellow with the Institute this year, on a topic yet to be announced, but trust me, it's going to be terrific. On the 20th of November, we'll have Katrina Hecht and Kate Summers talking about the variable experience of money of the wealthy and poor in London. And Susanna Wessendorf of the Institute is going to be talking on the 4th of December on the topic of how long-established ethnic minorities in East London are responding to new immigration into the neighborhood. Oh, and tomorrow we'll have a public event at 6:30 in the evening featuring Kate Pickett and Richard Wilkinson giving a talk at the Sheikh Zayed Theater, the new economic building, titled The Inner Level, How More Equal Societies Reduce Stress, Restore Sanity, and Improve Well-Being, basically describing how inequality kills. So today, it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Luna Glücksberg. Luna is a researcher at the International Inequalities Institute from the inception, or
pretty about, much.
Right? Yeah. So she got her training as an urban anthropologist at Goldsmiths, among other topics. She has studied the reproduction of elites in the truest Bourdieusian sense of the word, and has explored alternatives to capitalism, like the case study of the Basque Country, which she'll be presenting today. So Luna will talk for about 45 minutes, and after that we'll open it for Q&A.
Thank you, Jonathan.
Well, it's a real pleasure to be here opening this, this seminar series, so thank you for inviting me. And it's a pleasure to talk about this work. It's the first time I'm presenting it outside of the Basque Country, which is a real pleasure because it's very weird to present to people how they are and who they are directly to them. Any Basques in the audience? No. Even better. Okay, so, well, the background and the easy bit is that we know already that inequality is a problem. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here and we wouldn't have the Inequalities Institute. So, we're all familiar with these kind of figures that in very different ways describe the rise of inequality and the capture of growth from the top. So, we know that that is the situation we're in. You will all probably be familiar as well with the book, The Spirit Level, which about 10 years ago opened up an interesting debate on inequality as from a niche concern, you could say, of some economists. Of course, Piketty then opened this up even more. And for those who are not familiar with the authors of The Spirit Level, who are Wilkinson and Pickett, who will be here tomorrow, they are epidemiologists. Although by background they are also they have background in economic history and physical anthropology, and with that book they convincingly argue that inequality in society is bad for all, so not just for the poor but for anyone, and they showed very convincingly that the outcomes on all sorts of negative parameters from homicide, violent rape, murder. All sorts of outcomes turned out to be much worse in countries that were more unequal. Now, ever since then, and of course with Piketty as well, the study of inequalities has gained immense traction, and there are lots of scholars and institutions studying the effects of inequality and how we can fight it. What I want to do here today is a slightly different thing and think and talk a little bit about equality and what it looks like. What does it do to a society? How does a society work if it's more equal than what we are used to? What's it like to live there? And slightly more further, how does change or social innovation come about in a more equal society? And finally, is there anything that we can learn from equal societies and from exploring them ethnographically? Now, for a little bit of background, this study was called the Ethnographic Exploration of the Socioeconomic Transformation of the Basque Country. Now, what is the transformation, and indeed, what is the Basque Country? Can you see this thing? It's a bit. I don't know how to make it.
We should put those blinds on the window, and that might prevent.
Does that make it better?
Yeah.
Okay. So, obviously this is Spain, and the Basque Country is this small region up here. Actually, the Basque Country extends into France as well, but that's a different story. And for the purposes of this, we'll use data that relates just to the Spanish part of the Basque Country. What is the transformation that we are referring to? Now, Basque Country at the moment is an interesting place to consider questions of equality due to its rather unusual and surprising socioeconomic profile. Now, disclaimer here, I'm not an economist, I'm an anthropologist. So if you have further questions about Gini coefficients and variations, I'd be very happy to take them, but do bear in mind that's not my strength. Okay. So, however, here, I'm not sure if you can see them, but I can read them if you like. These are data from the Basque government. So these are their own data. And what they suggest is that whilst the Gini coefficient in Europe averages 31.0, the Basque Country is on 25.8, which is quite a remarkable difference. And then, anyway, I can read them for you. These are OECD data, and these are somehow less striking, but still suggest a remarkable difference between the Gini of this region at 0.302 and the rest of Spain at 0.341, the UK 3.22, and the US at 391. So there seems to be something going on in this region that is different from the rest. What is more, sorry about that. Anyway, what this slide shows is that GDP per capita in the Basque Country is the second highest in Spain, only second to Madrid, and actually comparable to the wealthiest areas in Europe. So what we have is a combination of both high degree of equality and a high degree of growth and development. So they're not just equal because they're poor. They're equal and highly developed. And this is especially remarkable for a region that at the beginning of the 80s was essentially on its knees, socially and politically, after years of fascist dictatorship by Franco and sustained decades of violence by a terrorist group, ETA. From a historical perspective, in the 80s, the Basque Country began following a development strategy that deviated markedly from the dominant neoliberal trajectories of the US and the UK, which devalued manufacturing and invested heavily in the financial and service sectors. So in the 80s, the Basque Country invested instead in its industrial capacity, generating jobs and a degree of shared prosperity that is sometimes referred to as the Basque transformation or the Basque model. Now, although it's not the focus of what I'm doing here, any discussion of the Basque Country would be impossible without talking about Mondragon. Now, Mondragon is both a town. Hang on, I put a triangle around it. This is not going very well. Well, it's around here. This is the Basque Country. That's San Sebastian. Up there is Bilbao. Arrecife is around here, 1 hour from both the main cities and up in the valleys. Arrecife is the Basque name of Mondragon. Mondragon is both a city, but also one could easily say at least one of the most successful groups of cooperatives in the world. The world's largest industrial cooperative association, this is how they describe themselves in a report produced by the Young Foundation very recently. The organization was founded in 1956 to provide work and employment to local people. It is not, as often people think, one huge cooperative. It is a system of different cooperatives that are, you could say, confederated. They work together, but each cooperative is independent and makes its own decision. That's very important to them. So we have over 260 at the moment different companies and subsidiaries with over 75,000 workers in 35 countries. Now, of course, one of the big problems with Mondragon, which again I'm not going to explore here, is the fact that their cooperative model does not necessarily translate in how they operate abroad. So it's not a whole kind of black and white story of the good guys of the cooperatives. But still, they have annual revenues of over 12 billion euros, and they describe themselves, that's how they describe themselves, is humanity at work in their latest rebranding. Now, although this work was not specifically centered on Mondragon, the influence of the cooperatives, which are not just Mondragon cooperatives, there are cooperatives all over the place in the Basque Country, goes beyond the valley and much deeper into the fibre of what the Basque Country is about. For the purpose of this presentation, the one key figure to remember is that the pay ratio from shop floor to CEO in each cooperative are about 1 to 6 to 1 to 9. 1 to 9 is seen as pretty bad. They don't like 1 to 9. Now, this shows that in the US, these are US companies, top largest 350 US companies, the ratio is between 2 and 300, broadly speaking. So that is just for a comparison, that's what we are talking about. That's a structural thing underlying the values that I'll be discussing. So, as I said, the aim of the project was to understand why and how this came to be. How come that this region that was on its knees did this thing that was completely different, re-industrialized, and ended up with values that are out of kilter with everywhere else? What were the values, the beliefs, and the narratives that informed unexpected and bold decisions in many different fields, because it wasn't just economics. It was policy, civic action, human rights. Of course, I mean, I don't have time here, but human rights issue was huge in that the Basque Country can probably, broadly speaking, be described as a post-conflict society now, and a post-conflict society with a thriving economy. These two things don't necessarily go together very often. So, what values drove this transformation and what can be learned? As I said earlier, another key issue was that of change, transformation, or social innovation. How can it be achieved on a large scale? And the interesting questions here were, if the answer was to be found in the models that we are normally used to think about, with innovation coming from an individualistic and hero-driven model, thinking of Steve Jobs and Elon Musk, or maybe from a small region that, as we will see, can be described as a social innovation ecosystem where everyone is empowered to be an innovator and start up cooperatives, groups, associations, all sorts of things. And so this, what we explore here today, is what kind of society can nurture such an ecosystem and what are the core values binding its people. Now, I don't think I'll have time to go into each one of them. Wow, this one shows. Can you read this one? Okay, good. So, but the state, no, methodology. Okay, pardon. So the project was the result of 6 months, broadly speaking, of qualitative research, including a little bit of background and quantitative work to ascertain the structural side of this change. The main part were two periods of ethnographic fieldwork in the Gipuzkoan region. It's one of the three regions that make up the Basque Country, so it's broadly speaking where San Sebastian is, if you're familiar with the area. And of course the Mondragon Valley. These was carried out between September and November 2017, and then there were interpreting seminars at McGill and Columbia University to sort of try and understand and work out with people who have been studying the Basque transformation for a long time. In total, I conducted about 30 recorded interviews, but there were many, many more conversations and informal exchanges that took place. Language-wise, I can speak Spanish, so the interviews were run in Spanish, although there were plenty of places where Basque was the only language, so I did have to use translators. I specifically wanted to speak to as wide a range of respondents as possible, so I had professors, business leaders, CEOs, as well as canteen workers, housewives, office workers and carers. I had people for whom Basque was the first and only language, and people who could not speak Basque at all, including families that had been in the region for generations, others who had only just recently moved in from the rest of Spain, but also from South and Central America, which is where the immigration of that region comes from. And it's difficult for them because although Spanish is a useful language to get about, the question of whether you can integrate properly without Basque is certainly a concern. Now, I think two methodological issues that skew my sample and that deserve a bit of a mention are these. One is gender. I spoke to around 20, well, the recorded interviews were 20 women and 10 men. This was done, the gender imbalance was partly really a desire to hear more from the women, because from my previous interactions with the region, I had spoken much more with men, so I wanted to overbalance and overcompensate, but it'd be useful to bear that in mind. And also the other skew that I have, which is, if I had to do more work, that is something I would like to explore more, is that my demographic was quite old. And in a sense that justified, because the point of the project was to understand why those decisions were made in the 80s. So I spoke with people that were in charge in the 80s. But it would certainly be interesting to hear more about how young people feel about it now. I would say that's pretty much what we need for methods. So the values. When we talk about values, it's always really difficult to extract and extrapolate and separate them, because, of course, they all blend into each other. I'm not a great graphic designer, but I try to express this with this rather simple Windows thing. Now, again, there isn't time to go into each of them in depth, but sociability and tight networks and family were absolutely crucial. I would ask people who are your networks, and they would describe literally, well, from my experience certainly, a much broader group and different associations that they were part of than anything that I was ever used to. And, well, just a quick anecdote for the family thing. As an urban researcher, I was very interested in how the local housing market, which of course is exploding in places like San Sebastian, would impact on this tradition of living together and living close to your family. And although, of course, as I'm sure you'll have heard, the rise of Airbnb and all these various things that push into places like certainly San Sebastian, people still somehow manage to be quite close to their family, and this mattered a lot. And it was something that sometimes wouldn't come out very well in translation. And one rather funny moment I had was when I asked someone, so do you live close to your family? And he said, no, I don't. And the translator, luckily, who knew this person, said, no, hold that a bit. Okay. So where do your family live? Well, it turned out there were three roads down from him. And actually, really, he wanted them to be on the same road, and his wife was very upset by this distance. So that's the kind of closeness, like really tight knit. And it included people that would, like younger people that would go and study abroad, but then come back and return, which was also, I thought, quite interesting. I didn't have time, and I don't have the data to go into that in depth, but it was quite interesting that this importance of going back. Anyway, so sociability, being for others was incredibly important, was a compliment that people would, like, I would ask, that's quite a standard anthropological thing, you ask what's the best compliment people can give someone around here. And being for others was absolutely the top answer. Ser por los otros. It was absolutely, yeah, that's how you translate it, being for others. But the one I want to talk about a little bit more now is Auzolan, because it seems to me that that is the most, the one that I certainly never heard of. Has anyone heard of that word before? Okay. So that seems it's key and it's important. And it's not something we're familiar with. Now, coming down from the being for others, there was a firm belief in the self as both effective and reliable. By this I mean that people seem to believe in their ability to affect, influence, and shape change. Now, Devani and others in 2017 have found that this belief correlates really highly with the likelihood of individuals being involved in their communities, actually above class. This was a UK study. And this was related, this belief in being effective was referred to and explained with the concept of Auzolan, which is a very old concept and refers and implied neighborhood solidarity and communal work that neighboring farms would undertake together in the past, for example, to keep a mountain road clear. Now, the geography of the Basque Country is that there's the ocean here and there's lots of parallel valleys that go towards the sea. So it's actually, in all the times, the communities are quite isolated and deeply self-reliant. So it was important that each members of these farms, these caseríos, which would normally hold two or three generations at least. Yes?
So does self-reliance just mean very specifically at the level of the community, not at the level of the individual or family? Or could it be across both?
It does go across, and I'll get into that. It does. So there's two parts to this, because it's both self-reliance and cooperation. So the key part they stressed was that it wasn't simply about helping others, it was about taking care of yourself and your own. So you cannot engage in Auzolan unless your farm is taken care of. That's how it was explained in those times. So at the same time, solidarity, it expresses solidarity and a deep level of self-reliance. A communal outlook goes hand in hand with self-reliance and self-responsibility. Now, behind this, there's also belief that, which I think is really important to equality, that the other is like you, self-reliant, and therefore worthy of your help. Now, I think I can explain this through a comparison that would be quite familiar with you here in Britain. Now, we all know that there's a powerful narrative that wants to convince us all that there are others out there that are lazy, waiting for handouts, not willing to help themselves, the scroungers. Now, this narrative of the other as different and lazy is used to justify a number of cruel policies that we're all aware of, and a retreat and retrenchment of the welfare state, that net that used to hold us safe. But in this context, citizens are much more likely to be willing to help others within a system that has less inequality because the other is like you. So, yeah, I think I need to hurry up here. Say, in a, again, going back to that rural space, it's not just that I would help my neighbour because I'm a kind person. Yes, I am a kind person, but also if I help them bring the harvest in, I know that they will help me bring my harvest in. They are capable, organized, solid, and we share responsibility for the space. There's a very strong sense, which to me is very key to how everything works in that. And yes, going back to Paul's question, it also works on an individual level and family level. One question that I really liked asking people was, after the broad one of who do you associate with, who are your broad networks, I would ask them, who can you rely on if you were to go to hospital or had financial problems, real debt, real issues? And they would all come up with at least, well, they would say, well, family, of course, and then I would ask them to name them. And there would be at least four or five people that they would absolutely, solidly be convinced they would be there for them. And at least three or four friends. So you end up with a person that has around 5 to 10 people that they think happily they can count on. And the question is not troublesome for them. Which, if you think of what's happening here, I mean, obviously, it's always a comparative thing, but the way that the social net has fallen, the way that homelessness, food banks, the way that people are seemingly so alone in facing the hardness of life, it's quite a different perspective. Okay, I'm good. So, one example of Auslan in practice in the current time, and a story that I won't tell because I think it's quite interesting. Are you familiar with, or have you ever heard of Sociedad in the Basque context? Okay, so it's not all about bringing in the harvest, and you can use this concept for much more fun purposes. So, broadly speaking, people live in flats, some bigger, some smaller, but that's how the living arrangements are organized. But there is a problem because eating together socially in rather large numbers is quite a key part of sociality and of all how these relationships are kept and developed. And so there is a problem because if I want to have a good 30 people for lunch because I'm celebrating something and I live in a flat, I have a bit of a problem. And they've come up with these societies, these gastronomic societies, which of course are cooperatives. And so you join a society for a fee per year, and you then have access to a room with tables and a commercial grade kitchen. So all you have to do is bring in your ingredients, cook all together, and then eat all together. What's even better, you don't even have to clean up. You have to clean up your table, you bring everything to the kitchen, and then there is, of course, a cooperative of cleaners that come in and clean. So, you know, it's just a small example, but that is a way of turning sociality into something that doesn't kill you economically because you're not taking 30 people to the restaurant and getting into debt in the process, and just arranging things together. But these places have bars, and you just write down, I don't know, 5 bottles of wine to that table. Of course, there's a committee at the top that runs things and makes sure that everything is done correctly, the committee rotates. And they didn't think that this was in any sense strange. I thought it was quite strange and quite remarkable. So those concepts, those old notions of reciprocity and mutuality that existed in the past exist very much in the present too, although they come out in different ways. So, again, quickly, another phenomenon, another value, it's not a value, it's a configuration really, that I thought was interesting and important was the concept of the quadrillas. Quadrillas are groups of friends that start very early on in primary school. Now, that's quite normal, everyone has friends in primary school. But what's interesting is that they endure. They last over people's lifetime. So I would be speaking to people who were in their 60s. And they would say, amongst others, there's my quadrilla friends. And now what's interesting here is that the fact that they endure for such a long time means that people that were together in primary school and then kind of can have very different careers, different paths in life, remain connected and sort of hang out together, maybe not meet every week, but broadly speaking, maybe every month, or come together for birthdays. So these quadrillas sort of cut through a social hierarchy that is already flatter than what we have here. And so I spoke with engineers that had CEOs in their groups of friends. And, you know, they just meet and chat, eat. That's fundamentally a lot of what they do. Yeah, it was a nice field work. But, you know, this idea of kind of echo chambers and media spaces where you're only on Twitter and you only speak to people who have your same ideas is very much demolished by this continuous network of interactions, including with people that do different things, journalists and cleaners and caterers. And I literally have spoken with people who would say, these are my quadrillas. Okay, so what happens in terms of social change? Because that was the other question that we were asking. So what does equality look like? What's it like to live in a more equal society? And what happens with change? Now, what my data show is that innovation or transformation in the region is reliant upon three key factors: safety and stability together, equality and self-belief. Now, safety is guaranteed and supported by two things. On the one hand is the fact that the fundamental needs of people in the region are met, both by a labour market that works and provides people with good jobs, but also a very well integrated welfare system that means that being unemployed is not a tragedy. Secondly, the network that people are so deeply involved with generate, as explained earlier, a deep sense of security that results in them not being scared of being alone in facing the difficulties that life will obviously throw at us. So sickness, disability, unemployment, financial difficulties. They are safe. There is a net there. Why does that feeling of safety matter? Because it guarantees the stability that is, I argue, necessary to have the time, space and energy to take stock of the situation around them and think about changing it creatively. Without a degree of stability, it's impossible. It would be impossible to do all the activities that the respondents mentioned and that I observed. The word cooperative is in their children's schools. Of course, the schools are cooperatives. I didn't have time to get into that. The schools are cooperatives. They held political office. They organize their community to achieve all kinds of changes, better playgrounds, better facilities for immigrants, revitalizing local agriculture. My sample was not selected to be activists, and yet everyone seemed to be doing something, which again goes back to this thing: you are a good person if you are involved in the community. You're absolutely not a good person if you do that thing of, you know, when we hear on the news here somewhere or some other there's been a murder or something terrible, and the vox pop says, oh, but they were such a good family, they kept themselves to themselves. That's the highest degree of praise we can give them. They kept themselves to themselves. Whilst here, the praise, I mean, that would be seen as dubious and not such a good thing. So they're doing all these things, and they're constantly improving society around them. Literally, it's a constant process. It's not a specific thing that one genius does. There's cooperatives everywhere. There's ways of innovating and changing everywhere. The other bit that I think matters a lot is that innovation requires risk-taking. Quitting a job to start a business, going part-time to volunteer, investing your savings in something you want to try. How can you expect an average citizen with families to care for to take risk if they don't have a net to fall back on? In fact, we know that the story of the innovator that changed everything from the garage, usually, if you dig a little bit, there's a solid middle-class family behind them. They usually don't come from those backgrounds where they had to work all hours just to make sure that they were fed. So, my argument is that these nets, this sense of stability and security, mean that they're not fearful of being left destitute, homeless and starving, or without medical assistance even. I mean, we're lucky not to have this here, but if we think about the US, that's the risk that you take if you leave your job. Should you fail in your endeavor, the risks are lower, the stakes are lower. So these circumstances exist in society because there are nets to catch people, and risks can be taken and managed in a much easier way as part of a supportive community that is there to hold you no matter what. Equality here is a key variable that, in that it both generates and supports stable, supportive, and reciprocal relationships. Yes, of course, again, without getting into too much detail, but education is a key component of this, because it's not just the practice and what they do in the schools, but the firm belief from the parents' perspective that education was important, relevant, and worth investing in for their children. And I don't mean just investing in terms of money, of course, although one of the, you know, nuances, if you want, is that the education system does include the Ikastolas, which are the schools that teach in Basque, of which people are hugely proud. They are cooperatives, but you also have to pay in order to become a member. So there is potentially a problem there with the Ikastolas becoming more Basque, but also to an extent a little bit more exclusive. So it's not all completely equal. But all the same, the sense that the education of your children is the most important thing that you can invest in is spread across the board. It would be something that a caterer would say to me, a taxi driver, just in the same way as a more middle-class parent here that understands how the games need to be played and how important it is for their children to get their 11 plus or be placed in a private school. And it mattered not just because the individual would then go on to earn higher income and then be safer. It mattered as this is how we progress as a society. The outlook was very different. Education was important, but from a communal point of view, this is how we move forward, this is how we get better. So, that's the values. So, the questions at the beginning were, what's it like to live in a society that's more equal, how does change happen, and is there anything we can learn from this kind of society? If we want to phrase this and try to embed it a little bit in the literature that we have on what and how inequality works, I always find this quote by Mike Savage very useful. I like it as an image of the landscape as an increasingly vertiginous social landscape with a lot more rock and earth and high mountains rising much further above the valley than they did 3 years ago. This is him, well, you can read it yourself, but describing the idea that in order to get to the top of society, you have this rocky landscape that you have to climb, and it's hard. And of course, if you can, you literally take your children up and allow them to start the whole route to the summit from the highest base camp you can. That's the whole point of elite reproduction. In a very similar vein, Danny Dorling uses this image. Dorling is a, I would imagine you're familiar with his work, as a geographer at Oxford that has worked, I think, all his life to describe and fight inequality. And he uses this image, which I really like, because to me, I mean, it's quite obvious, this is the unequal society, and that's the equal one. But I like it because to me it really captures what it felt like to be in the Basque Country. It really felt like the ladder was like that. So it wasn't so terrible to fall down, it wasn't so difficult to climb, and you could hold on much more easily. Now, this can seem very fluffy as analysis, because saying that people seem happier in a more equal society is not exactly very academic. However, I'm very lucky, because we now have a new body of evidence that demonstrates on a large scale with epidemiological data what I have tried to explain here on a small scale and in an ethnographic way. Wilkinson and Pickett, the authors of the spirit level, whom I quoted at the beginning, have very helpfully for me produced another book, The Inner Level, which shows exactly, and I quote from their book, how more equal societies reduce stress, restore sanity, and improve everyone's well-being. So literally, that. Now, I have no intention of spoiling their presentation tomorrow, because that would be rather rude. But it would be very remiss of me to not point out the similarities between what they have found on a large scale with large data sets and what I have found here on a small scale ethnographically, trying to describe and understand how people live in these less unequal societies. Now, I haven't done many quotes, but I always like this one to describe what I mean when the... So people have a community dimension. This translates in thousands of things: the association movement, the spirit of cooperation. It's about focusing on the community dimension of individuals. And then this same person explained it a little bit more in his own experience. So he lives in a block of 42 apartments, and there's a bar at the bottom, which is quite a common thing. And he never goes home without going through the bar, and same as his wife, to drink something together and just be with people. In this case, the community of the bar. And it's not, they don't go there to drink wine. It's about being part of this thing. You don't go just to see the football. You go to be with the group. And this group includes your children and the children of others. That was the other thing that was interesting. These groups were very intergenerational. So I went to a demonstration once. Yes, of course, the Catalan thing was exploding, so Bilbao was very much demonstrating at the time. And you couldn't move because people kept meeting each other. It was impossible. I have no idea how those people could even go on, because they just met and stopped in places to eat or drink, and somehow the demonstration still happened, but it wasn't very mobile. They weren't going anywhere fast, because they just kept meeting each other, because that's what they do. And, I mean, I joke here, but I think actually it means quite a lot And just to conclude, again, this is their conclusion. Piketty and Wilkinson argue strongly for what they call economic democracy in their book, the one about DNA level. I.e., various forms of cooperative employees-owned or controlled corporations, the inclusion of employees on boards, and so on. Now, why do they do that? Because they believe that inequality cannot be fixed without providing individuals with effective and adequate economic resources, i.e. incomes. So I've spent all this time talking about values. Values are wonderful, but they actually need a supporting thing underneath, which is incomes. People need to have enough money to live. They are in favor of this particular configuration because they believe that redistribution through taxes is too volatile and too vulnerable to new governments coming in and taking away what has been given in terms of, you know, benefits, fundamentally. Whilst if you ingrain economic democracy through shared ownership, it's much harder to then take it away. And you end up with a distribution of profits that is much more equal. Remember again the 1 to 6 to 1 to 9 ratio to the 1 to 300 that we have here. So in this presentation, I've spoken mainly of values and how people relate to each other, because that was the brief of my project. I needed to find out what values had generated this kind of society. But it would be impossible to overestimate the importance of the structural levels of equality achieved through the cooperatives and other forms of employee control on the distribution of profits in the vast country. The underlying facts of salary ratios as low as 1 to 6, 1 to 9, do influence the ways in which people relate to each other. Again, as Piketty and Wilkinson argue, that if people are not struggling to establish their worth and status and value constantly, they can spend more time engaging in ordinary, banal, if you want, things like relating and caring for your family and friends, your children, and living, instead of just surviving or making a living. So, very much to conclude, the findings of the project can be summarized with the fact that these exceptional decisions that were taken during the 80s and leading to the Basque model or the Basque transformation were made following long-established and deeply held values, respecting communities and the real concern for individuals, the region and its inhabitants in the long term, not just the short term. And those resonated perfectly with the values that dominated at the time. So in that sense, they represent continuity rather than a rupture. In terms of our question today as to what it's like to live in a more equal society, findings show that those same values hold true today. And although people might not live in the caseríos like they once did, the density and intensity of their social networks is remarkable and clearly key in their egalitarian views, which in turn generate practices of reciprocity and mutuality. If the rural roots of the caseríos and the concept and practices of Auzolan have influenced the cooperatives and produced a more egalitarian system than most, the extended social networks, deeply held, deep family connections and long-term friendship networks have in turn promoted a climate where people feel confident enough to express their ideas, participate in improving their lives, their workplace, their communities, their schools, which is what social innovation is. And so their lives are not run by the imperative to produce at all costs at threat of destitution and social isolation. The environment is supportive and conducive to people feeling empowered enough to think about and take action to continuously improve their world. So this seems to undermine the idea that a competitive, highly individualistic model such as the San Francisco Silicon Valley one will produce the best outcomes, and in a sense tells us something that we know already. If we want children to succeed, we use positive reinforcement. A positive, nurturing environment produces social innovators And that's what the Basque Country has done. And what does this mean for us? I think for the study of equality and inequality, at the very least, this shows, this work shows ethnographically in a very specific way what we intuitively already know and what Pickett and Wilson will show us tomorrow, that more equal societies reduce stress, restore sanity, and improve everyone's well-being. So see you tomorrow there.